Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore. When you shop with an independent, you keep your money in the community, and you also enable us to keep having events like this one. James Rollins has been one of my favorite authors for a long time, and I could go on and on and on, but I won't. The Doomsday Key explores human overpopulation, the diminishing food supply, and genetically modified crops. And if that's not enough, Gray Pierce and Sigma Force go on a global hunt for a powerful group of industrialists who have a stranglehold on the world's food supply. Please join me in welcoming the author of The Doomsday Key, James Rollins.
Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate that. Sharing the evening. I'm always surprised anybody shows up to my signings. Like, what are the people doing here? There's a good television on right now. Did anybody happen to see my little spot on Channel 9 News? No, you did. Okay. Did you happen to notice that right when they cut to me, I was cracking up? Because the segment right before I was they were airing, they sit you at, you know, up on the table, and they just show the newscast, but you're sitting right next to them already. And the segment just before mine, they should have warned me. It was about a clown robber, and you know, and next up a clown robber, and I'm thinking that's odd. Who would target clowns, you know, specifically to arrest? But the worst thing about that, the description of that clown, the clown robber, was the police have a description of the clown robber. He was wearing a purple fright hair and white paint and possibly a red rubber nose. Now, what amused me was possibly the red rubber nose. Like, how odd was this guy's nose that they couldn't quite figure out whether it was a rubber nose or his real nose? So I just, you know, I was trying to hold back a laugh as they cut to me. Hey, tell us about the end of the world, and I'm cracking up. So what I'm going to do, I love coming to a place where no one's seen me, where we've never talked before. I've never been. This is the first time I've actually done a signing in the Denver area, so it's sort of exciting to be able to be here and have a new audience that has never heard my stories before. Because, you know, I do Sacramento where I live, and it's like, oh, well, you know, okay, great, he's going to tell that story again. Now no one's bored. If you heard this story, put your head down and rest. Now, you know, you have no reason. Well, you may put your head down and rest because I'm boring you, but hopefully not. Oh, well, thank you. No, come on. So I thought what I'm going to do is just talk a little bit about myself, how I became a writer, just briefly. I won't bore you too long, and talk a little bit about the Doomsday Key, and then open up for questions, because I like to have a lot of time for Q&A, mostly because, like I said, I don't know why people are here. I'm always curious, so hopefully when you ask questions, I'll get a hint of why you're here. I know whenever I go to book signings, I always have a question or two in my head, and if the author doesn't get to it, then I think, I'm never reading that guy again. So hopefully we won't have that scenario here, and we can answer everybody's question. So those that don't know a bit about myself, I'm a veterinarian in Sacramento. I had my own practice for 20 years, had my own practice for 15 of those 20 years, because that was my first love, was veterinary medicine. And I remember from third grade, I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian. I had that. I mean, everybody's had that essay when they're in elementary school. What do you want to be when you grow up? I had that essay, and I remember sitting at my desk as a third grader. It was a point of moral dilemma. I'm thinking, I want to be a veterinarian, just don't know how to spell it. So I thought, well, I know how to spell policeman, and I know how to spell fireman. They're great professions. I could just fill this essay out and go out and play. But I did the one thing that all third graders don't like to do is I went and got the dictionary and looked it up. Because I was that determined from third grade to be a veterinarian. You know, it's something that was always a passion of mine. And I didn't, you know... That's what I career track towards. But that was, of course, this side of my head. You know, the nice side. Oh, he likes animals, so he takes care of animals. Unfortunately, I have this side of my brain. This side of my brain, I blame my parents for. My mom in particular. Is that she had too many kids. I've got three brothers and three sisters, so that can they people can do math. That's seven kids. We were raised Polish Roman Catholic, and you know, to keep the Polish flag in your front yard, you had to have at least six kids. So I always thought my mom just had an extra one spare. You know, just in case you lost one, she could still keep the flag. So I was just in case you're going to ask, I was the third, so I was a typical middle child, but I had, you know, four younger siblings still, and they were my four earliest victims to what I call my storytelling talent, what gets birthed out of this side of my head. And, you know, it was never a good day unless I could make one of my brothers or sisters cry. You know, my mom called, you know, I call it storytelling, my mom called it lying, it's, you know, it's the same thing. But it just it was with my joy in life. Do you want to hear one of my earliest stories about what I used to share with my brothers and sisters? I had a whole slew of them, and everybody from Sacramento's heard all of them. So I'll just do one of them. If you want to hear other ones, I can tell you in Q&A if you want, if we have the time. But you know, I shared a bedroom with my younger brother, Chuck. When I was about 11, and Chuck was maybe 9, I got a ventriloquist doll for Christmas. Now, it's a Charlie McCarthy doll, creepy enough in and of itself. And I thought I was going to be the world-famous ventriloquist. I'm going to throw my voice. What fun that I was going to have with that. Well, that lasted for about 2 minutes. And, you know, I like to move my lips when I talk, so I gave it up immediately. But I still had this thing. What am I going to do with this thing? So I'm looking at this. I'm looking at Brother Chuck, looking at this. And I sort of get an idea. I got an idea. So I got my copy of Lord of the Rings. I was an avid reader as a kid. It's one of the reasons, you know, reading is like throwing gasoline on this side of my brain. And so I got Lord of the Rings. I flipped to the back. And the back of Lord of the Rings is a bunch of runes. And so I copied a bunch of runes on a sheet of paper, crumpled it all up, burned the edges, folded it up, stuck it in the pocket of the doll. Later on that day, I'm just saying, hey, Chuck, look, there's something in the pocket of the doll. Why don't you see what it is? Oh, all right. So he pulls it out and unwraps it. Ooh, there's weird writing on it, some scribbling. So let me see that. You know, gosh, it really looks old. It almost looks ancient, doesn't it, Chuck? Yeah. Look how, you know, I think I recognize this writing. You do? Yeah, I think I do. Hang on a second. Then I went and got my copy of Lord of the Rings. Flip to the back, and look, it's the same writing. It is, yeah. Chuck, I think I can translate this. This is probably a coded message from centuries ago. It might be a treasure map. It might be some incantation, some magic. Give me a second. Let me see if I can solve this. Set to work, comparing, pretending to compare. Well, the first word, Chuck, is it's coming out. Here it is. Beware. Beware? Chuck, should I continue on? Yeah, okay. Hang on. Beware, after midnight, I rise and hunt for blood. Uh-oh. Jim, do you think that's real? It looks real, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, just to be safe, let's put that back in the doll's pocket. And maybe, you know, before we go to bed, we should make sure the doll's locked up every night. Let's put him in the closet, make sure the door's shut. And they just reinforce that for a couple of weeks. You know, is the doll in the closet? Yeah, I think so. Are you sure it's in the closet? Yeah. Did he close to clicks? Because, you know, it might pop open. He might, you know, just make sure it's closed. Just reinforce that. About 3 weeks later, then the fun begins. Just wake up about 2 o'clock in the morning, take the doll out of the closet, shove it underneath my brother's blankets, just wait for morning. It's very simple. As you can well imagine, that next morning, it did require changing some sheets, but it was still worth it. So that was this side of the brain. But I never thought you could make a living with this side of the brain. So, you know, once I got grown up, I career tracked towards being a veterinarian, and it was very busy, and I continued to read, and like I said, it was like throwing gasoline. So a part of me always wanted to attempt to write, but I thought, who makes a living as a writer? And I just sort of dismissed it. Dabbled with a bit of hobby in my early college years. I've had no formal training. I was, like I said, taking all my science classes that I need to get into vet school. And that went on and on and on, and I kept saying, one of these days I want to write, one of these days I want to write, and on and on and on. It's another one of those points of moral dilemma. Okay, why I started to write, what eventually turned that one of the, I figured I got turned 30 years old, I don't have an infinite number of one of these days, if I'm going to write, I better write. That's a lie. I'm still lying. I'm just debating whether I have to turn the podcast off for this part. Okay. How many people listen to the podcast? You have a big audience?
I don't know. Jeremy, do you have a big audience?
Okay, I'll tell you, but we may need to edit this out. We'll see. Why I really began to write, what finally was at the turning point, was that I was doing payroll one night, and I had 23 employees at that point, so I was up late doing payroll. And if you have the television on late at night, the only thing that's on is infomercials. And up pops a very famous infomercial guy, Tony Robbins. Anybody familiar with Tony Robbins? Big hair, big teeth, sort of scary. Makes people walk on fire. And he was promoting this tape series, motivate yourself, motivate anybody around you. It's, you'll change your life. And it's droning on in my ear, and just sort of like, it's like that subliminal message. It just sort of drills into your head. And eventually I'm going, he's right. Tony Robbins is right. I need that tape set. I've got these, veterinary managers. This will really motivate them. So I ordered it. A few weeks later, in comes a tape set, and what it is basically, it's 24 individually wrapped cassette tapes. Just to give you how long ago that was. It was not CDs, it was cassette tapes. So I figured I better listen to this first before I, foist it upon my managers. And so I open up the first tape, and on side A of the tape, it says, take out a sheet of paper. And by the way, I never finished my story about the veterinary, that third grade veterinarian. The odd part of that story is, if you jump forward to my first day of veterinary school, the entering class is sitting there. The dean walks in and he goes, all right, everybody take out a sheet of paper. Sort of like Tony Robbins. Yeah. It's a one question pop quiz. Write down the word veterinarian. Now, not everybody got it right. Of course, I did, because from third grade, I was prepared to answer that question. So Tony Robbins did the same thing. He said, take out a sheet of paper. Close your eyes and dismiss any type of preconception you have about yourself, whether it's your educational background, your financial background, where you're living. Just dismiss everything. Just write down on that sheet of paper what you would love to do for the rest of your life. So I wrote down, I would love to be a novelist. I would love to write. Side B of the tape, to flip it over, it basically says, okay, whatever you wrote on that sheet of paper before the sun sets, you've got to make one small step towards that. You don't have to accomplish that goal. You have to make one small step towards that. Buy a book, make a call, sign up for a class, talk to somebody. Just make one small step towards that goal. And I said, okay, I will honor that, because you have to obey Tony Robbins. So I set up a little typewriter by the corner of my house, and it didn't have a computer even at that ancient year. It was just a typewriter. And began my writing career. So that was my tipping point. So I owe my career to Tony Robbins. Do not tell Tony Robbins. I do not want him coming to my front step and going, hey, I've got a new infomercial. I need you to promote it. So that was the point in which I actually started to write. I wrote a bunch of bad short fiction, because at that point I was working. I didn't think I had time for a novel. And luckily all those stories are safely buried in my backyard, hopefully never to see the light of day. But eventually I felt comfortable enough to tackle my first novel, and then I ended up having that first novel sell, and that began my career. So that's basically how a veterinarian became an author. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the Doomsday Key right now. And if you want to have any questions about how I went from to become published, it was a rocky road. As I was telling Mark here, I got rejected by 50 different agents for that first book, and I wasn't not even rounding up or rounding down. It wasn't 48, 49, 52, it was 50. The 50th agent agreed to represent that book. But so I'm going to talk about the Doomsday Key, and I'm always a little bit stymied on what, how to position this part of the talk, because I don't want to give too much away, and I don't want to, I don't want to just bore you by just sort of like the story. But so I thought, well, how am I going to handle that? So I decided to do this with the last book, The Last Oracle. I started this, and so I'm going to do the same thing with the Doomsday Key, because at some point during the Q&A, one of you is going to ask this question. It's the one question all authors hate to hear. Guess what it is? Go, hands up. Can't hear everything at once. There you go. It's always the first or second question. I mean, I'm always somewhat scared when I do that, all of a sudden that some audience is never going to guess that. What type of underwear do you wear? What type of, what's your favorite color? But no, it's where do you get your idea? We hate that. You want to torture an author? Just keep asking him that. Because we don't know. We have no idea. And we don't want to know. Because it's an ephemeral process. It's magical to us. And we're afraid if you make us look too closely at this process, it'll go away. So we don't like that. And initially, I thought that was just me. I attended a again, okay, let's be very careful because we're being taped. I attended. I was sitting in a just after Subterranean, my first book got published. I was attending an event by a mystery writer that I really enjoy. I shall not name that mystery writer. You could probably guess who the mystery writer is if you think Alphabet.
I didn't say Alphabet.
But okay, that's all I'm with. That's the only clue. You can figure it out from there. So she was up at the front doing this her talk, nice talk, and the Q&A started, and question, the first or second question was, where do you get your ideas from, Sue? I mean, time to edit. And she had a brilliant answer. It was very, very touching about how, you know, she internalizes her process and lets it out. And I was really impressed. And I'm thinking in the audience, I don't do that. I must be a bad author. And so I'm getting my book signed by her later on, and I get up to the desk, and so, you know, oh, I just love your writing, and I was really impressed by what your answer was to, you know, where you get your ideas from, and I've got my first book published, and, you know, I've just attended because I love you, I want to hear how you talk. She goes, you have your first book published? Yeah, yeah. And so, come over here. I said, what? I just made that all up. I have no idea where I get my ideas from. But you need an answer to that, because it's going to come up over and over again. So be prepared for that. So again, like I said, we don't like that.
So what's your
latest answer? Well, I don't have an answer. I pussyfoot and dance around that thing, as you will see right tonight. You will see me dancing like you've never seen me dance before, because I'm going to answer that question in regards to the Doomsday Key. Because there is a slight process that I have, and as you will see, it's what I mean by the magic of this process, and I don't want to analyze it too closely, is that it does seem a certain amount of serendipity and weirdness that is involved in this. And then I've got an old banker's box, a lawyer's box, one of those cardboard boxes that you put files in, and I just began sort of throwing things in there because I needed a place to throw an idea. You know, I subscribe to a lot of magazines, Discover, National Geographic, Scientific American, Smithsonian. And so whenever I see an article that interests me, either a bit of history that ends in a question mark or a bit of science that makes me go, what if, I just throw it in the box. It's disorganized. It's messy. If I watch the History Channel, if something comes up, I'll jot it down, throw it in there. There's no organization to it. Some authors are very organized. I'm not. It's, you know, probably somewhere at the bottom of the box is mice running around. But that's okay. I like that chaos because weird things end up next to each other just by pure chance. So a lot of times I have to sort of sift through because I don't want multiple boxes. I just want the one box because if you don't know it's magic to me, I'm afraid if anybody burns that box, I will lose all my talent because everything comes out of that box. And so I sift through it, and just I'll find just a bit of science, a bit of history that'll sort of end up next to each other, and I'll go, oh, that's a cool idea, and I'll follow it along, and sometimes nothing happens. It'll die on the vine, but other times I'll say, oh, this is a good story. I can write this. So what I'm going to do in regards to talking about Doomsday Key, I'm going to just tell some of the things that came out of that box that became this book. I'm not going to tell you how they connect. You're going to have to read the book, but just sort of share some of the things that came out of the box in reference to this book. One of the first things that came out of that box actually was when I was researching Last Oracle, and those that haven't read Last Oracle, it's about the Oracle of Delphi, which is a group of women that got high in hallucinogenic gases and had these visions. It's up to you to decide whether they were true visions or just hallucinations. But so I got very much into, you know, all these different world prophecies, and I started noticing that there was, you know, certain ones that were centered around the end of the world, time to our generation, something happening soon. And everybody's heard the Mayan prophecy 2012, you know, that's been done to death, and so, you know, I didn't really want to step on that. There's a huge movie coming out 2012 that looks really cool. I'll be watching it. But when I was doing my research for Last Oracle, I came across a really cool prophecy that I thought, I would love to play with this. I just don't know what, it didn't fit with Last Oracle, so we just went into the box. But it really stuck in my head. So when I was starting to work the next idea, I want to find a way to use that. And what that piece of prophecy is there's a Irish saint called Saint Malachi. And again, you know, Polish Roman Catholic, so I've got a lot of saints and popes drilled into me over the years. I was at a signing in Phoenix at the very beginning of this tour, and my cousin attended it, and she stands up, and it's got a huge crowd because Clive Cussler was there, so he draws a huge crowd. And she stands up and goes, okay, Jim, I was just wondering, how come in every one of your novels you kill a priest? I'm going, well, you know, I went to Catholic elementary school and Catholic middle school, and I may be working through some issues. I don't know. So, you know, when I'm reading this prophecy of St. Malachi, I was sort of intrigued, you know, being Catholic, you sort of get intrigued by those things. And he has this, St. Malachi was born or was lived during the 12th century. And according to his history, and he's just a little bit less known than St. Patrick. In Ireland, he's actually very well renowned. And he had a vision on a pilgrimage to Rome where he fell into a trance and he saw all the popes from his time, the 12th century, till the end of the world. And he wrote little descriptions of each of those popes. Now, over the centuries, each of those little descriptions ended up to be oddly accurate. Now, it's similar to Nostradamus, where you know, there's some vague reference that you can maybe tie to something. Maybe that's what's going on here. But over you know many, many centuries, each of those things seem to be, some of them are just vaguely accurate, but some are creepily accurate. Even to the current popes, Pope John Paul II is referred by St. Malachi in the 12th century as from the labor of the sun, which is a metaphor at the time for a solar eclipse. And Pope John Paul II was born during a solar eclipse. So it's an odd, rather, coincidence for that to happen. Pope Benedict was described by St. Malachi as the glory of the olives. And Pope Benedict got his name from the Benedictine order, whose symbol is the olive branch. So indeed, he is sort of the glory of the olives. So again, sort of creepy, sort of interesting. But what was really fascinating about that prophecy was that, according to St. Malachi, St. Benedict, the current pope, is number 111 on his list. There's only one more pope on his list after St. Benedict. According to St. Malachi, the next pope is called Peter the Roman, is how St. Malachi describes him. And that pope is going to reign when the world ends. So as a thriller writer, I'm thinking, that's so cool. I've got to find a way to use that. So I'm like, that's became a part of the story. So here we have the you know these Mayan priests predicting the end of the world in our 2012 right around the corner. We have St. Malachi predicting that the next pope's the end of the world. But out in that box a long time ago, probably almost 6 or 7 years ago, I had thrown in something that was sort of a scientific version of a prophetic end of the world scenario, and it was done by a sort of clandestine group called the Club of Rome. It's a think tank in Europe of a European aristocrats, businessmen, scientists. You can Google them. And they have a website. You can read about them. But in 1972, they produced a report called The Limits to Growth. And basically the gist of that report was that population is growing so fast that eventually it's going to outstrip our ability to produce enough food to feed that population, which sort of makes sense. You know, we are growing geometrically, and probably eventually we are going to hit a point where we can't feed that population. And we're probably close to that point already. There's food riots occurring in a lot of third world nations because they're running out of food. A lot of, you know, large swaths of the world are currently starving. But what I liked about, well, I don't know if like would be a good word for what I'm about to describe, what I found fascinating about this limits to growth study, and it was a statistical model, and they sort of analyzed what might happen if we reach that point. Hi, Wayne. If we hit that point and unchecked, what might happen? Their description was very biblical to me. They said, when we hit that point, there's going to be such chaos because we're unprepared for that, because it's going to happen suddenly, and it's going to spread worldwide. There's going to be such chaos that there's going to be war, there's going to be famine, there's going to be pestilence, there's going to be death. So I'm thinking, that's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And he says, when that happens, 90% of the world population will die off. 90%. I'm thinking, cool, I like that. Now, in the 1990s, as I was in the 1972, maybe there, you know, you've seen the clothes people were in 1972, so who knows if that was, you know, they were pretty crazy back then. Maybe that was not accurate. But in the 1990s, some universities attempted to disprove limits to growth, to prove that was not, there's no way 90% of the world was going to die off in that. And they now had more advanced computer modeling, that they can do the statistics with more accuracy. They set to disprove it, and actually they proved it. And if anything, the conclusion was the limits to growth was probably conservative. So, again, yay. So now I have the scientists proving that the world's about to end. I have very weird things that make me happy. So that ended up on the table. So I looked at a lot of things about doomsday, and I came across and this was also in this more recently in the box, because again, it just was a cool name. Anybody familiar with the Doomsday Vault? It's a underground crypt vault that was built underneath a mountain above the Arctic Circle by Norway, and they basically opened in 2008, and they're storing a bunch of seeds in there, basically to protect the seeds against any type of global calamity, whether natural or man-made, climate change, who knows what, something that just changes, nuclear war. Supposedly this vault can withstand a direct nuclear strike, and basically what they do is trying to protect the world's seeds so that if there is a natural catastrophe, at least we have a resource in which to repopulate. But the other reason is that they wanted to protect crop diversity. We're losing a lot of crops, just like we're losing animal species on a regular basis. Just to give you one example, there used to be 7,000 varieties of apples grown in the U.S. a century ago. 100 years ago, 7,000 varieties of apples. Today, there's only 300. So over the course of 100 years, we lost 6,700 varieties of apples, which is concerning because oftentimes different diseases will mutate some of the viruses, that like swine flu, that changes. There's certain things that hit crops just like it hits us, and it might hit a certain strain of crop, and another crop might be resistant to that, and if that crop is gone, then you know we lose that entire species. We ran that risk really closely with wheat one year. With the wheat rust spread, and it was just a rare species of wheat that was from Africa that was resistant to it, and we ended up incorporating that into our own wheat, and we're able to survive that. So that's really why they're doing it. But for me, as a thriller writer, I'm thinking, what did the Norwegians know? What do they know that they're not telling us? So that became in there. So that's sort of the history and a little bit of the science. I'm triggering it. With the Doomsday Vault, I'm creeping a little bit into the science part of the story. And as you can guess, I started studying about seeds and crops. And so I sort of remember that somewhere in there, I had a whole section of that, one corner of that box all crumpled up and wadded, was a bunch of stuff about genetically modified crops. And for those that don't know, genetically modified crops is a multi-billion-dollar industry, but it's very unregulated. Just to give you some scary facts that came out of that box is that last year, out of the 40 approved genetically modified crops that were approved to grow in the U.S., only 8 have published safety studies. Now, why should you be concerned about that? Is that, as you can well imagine, once you throw seeds out into the environment, Mother Nature is tricky, and we think we can control it, but oftentimes we, as multiple examples, we can't. To give you one example is that there was a test field where it supposed to be quarantined. Nothing was supposed to leave this field. Well, they found example or some of those plants growing wild 30 miles away from the test field. So clearly, not quite controlling. In the year 2000, there was a corn called Starlink that was released. It was not meant for human consumption because some of the reports suggested it could trigger allergic reactions in people, severe allergic reactions, so it was banned from human consumption. It could only be fed to cows and pigs, basically a feeder crop. Well, after a couple of years, many, many human products ended up having Starlink corn in it, including Kellogg's cereal. So it was a massive recall, a massive cleanup. It was one of the first sort of government bailouts of an industry. It was multi-million dollars to clean up the whole, just because of one genetically modified crop. So I'm just using that example of how uncontrolled everything, no safety studies, it escapes out of these test fields, it gets into our food supply. And then I came across something really cool. Well, again, I think it's cool. Is that I came across in 2001, a company called Epicyte developed a strain of corn genetically modified. They built in a contraceptive into the corn. So if you ate the corn, you become less fertile. So, because scientists do weird things. So, if you give them free rein, like, what can I put in the corn next? And I'm thinking the same thing as a thriller writer. What would I put in that corn? Another cornerstone of that book. So I'm not going to tell how all that connects together, how genetically modified corn, the Doomsday Vault, prophecies of the St. Malachi, prophecies of the Mayans, limits to growth, how that all ties together. Of course, I'm going to make you read the book. Actually, I don't care if you read the book. Just buy the book. That's what it really matters. So I'm going to end my formal discussion right there.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.